Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Next Deal podcast. This is Vince Hall. Along with me is the beautiful Justin Dossie. What up, Justin?
What up?
Here's what I want you to do, guys. Before we get started, I want you to like, subscribe, give us a follow. I can't tell you how much that helps. And we do have a special guest with us today. He is a veteran. House hacking is what really got him investing, I should say. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Dom Mustachio Franco. Welcome, dude.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate the intro, Vince.
No problem. We like to have some fun around here.
We do, and I made Vinny do the intro because I'm not that good at that.
Well, Dom, welcome. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what you're doing in real estate, and let's get this going.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dominic Franco, originally grew up in Pennsylvania, found myself down here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Last duty station was here in North Carolina, and the weather is much, much better than Pennsylvania. So decided to call this place home. Been doing full-time real estate investing since beginning of 2023 is when we technically started full-time. Prior to that, it was kind of like one live and flip and then like a house hack. Just really trying to make best use of those primary home loans. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at today.
Yeah. Okay. So the duty station, North Carolina, Fort Bragg.
Yes.
Hey, so that was one of my duty stations. So that is the home of psychological warfare.
Okay.
In Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So that's what I did in the military. How long were you in Fort Bragg?
I was there like 3 or 4 years, I think like three and a half.
Yeah. Did you live on base or in Fayetteville?
I lived in Spring Lake, right in Lion's Den, gotcha. Right outside of Manchester Gate.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah. I know all about that area, man. We could talk military all the time, all the whole podcast if you want. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
So what do you do in the military?
So I'm in the Air Force, and basically it's a joint certificate called a joint terminal attack controller. And what most people commonly would know that know is a forward air controller. So you coordinate airstrikes mostly for the Army, but anyone in the DOD. But the biggest part is liaisoning kind of like the air to ground pitcher or even surface to surface pitcher. So like anything that launches or explodes on the battlefield, we try and coordinate as best we can with the ground forces.
Yeah. So when we're calling in that 10 digit code, you're not throwing it on us.
That is the main goal, is to blow up not yourself or friendlies is really why we exist, to be honest. And to translate most of the time Air Force to Army and Army to Air Force.
Yeah. I mean, I remember clearly, flying out with the Air Force guys out of Fort Bragg, straight to Heidelberg, Germany in a C-130, which are not comfortable.
So that seems like a very uncomfortable flight.
It was.
Really? Yeah. Well, I guess y'all were packed probably. I did a Space A flight, so from Ramstein to Maryland. And one of them was in a C-130. The front half was like the hospital bay. So like dudes up on, stretchers and cots and stuff. But the back half like was just empty, and there's maybe like 12 of us. So you can just lay out like on the floor and just kind of sleep.
Well, yeah, I mean, we did lay out on the floor and stuff, but it's cold.
Yeah, it is a little chilly out there.
There were pallets everywhere, and you couldn't, you obviously can't lay in between pallets just in case. So you don't get crushed.
Don't get smashed. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, but the monkey seats on the side, it's just so uncomfortable when you're, flying to Germany from North Carolina.
Yeah.
But we did a an in-flight fuel, which was freaking fantastic. So I went into the cockpit and hung out with the guys in there while we were doing it. Scary as F just seeing that happen. But, they had like this little like joystick, and somebody had a little camera, and they were kind of, it's cool.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah. So you're still in the military, in the National Guard, and doing real estate. So, does that, ever conflict at all, or is it pretty, because you're only doing things on the weekends, I guess.
Yeah. So a big part of me coming out this way was two part. We were kind of between Raleigh and Charlotte. Both those markets have been growing, you know, rapidly in the last 5 years. So my guard unit is out here closer to Charlotte. It's about like 40, 50 minutes outside of it. And then my wife got accepted to UNC Charlotte. So that kind of pointed both of us in this direction. But yeah, the biggest thing was my leadership is super lenient. They understand that, you know, what we do outside of work is what pays the bills, not, you know, at drills. Right. But yeah, it hasn't really interfered at all, honestly. Like they're very understanding about it. And we do what's called super drill. So we do 4 days every other month instead of 1 week a month. Cause we have some dudes that travel kind of far to, and it helps accommodate that. Mm-hmm. And so overall they've been pretty supportive. You know, it does sometimes require some travel, like I have a currency to maintain and things like that. But overall, it really hasn't interfered too much. I mean, there's people that have a 9-to-5 that are investing in real estate. So, you know, four days every other month and a few trips here and there don't really stop me from doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Justin?
No, so that's cool. I was kind of curious to go back to what you started with at the beginning with house hacking, right? What was the first deal you did? Let's talk through that.
Yeah. See, I don't know if I would consider it a deal, but I'll go over the first house we bought.
Sure.
And really how this happened was, so I actually was in Germany before Bragg and was coming over. I was engaged and I was like, the 3 years prior to that, I lived overseas. So I was in Korea and then Germany and single, you know, 20 something year old. I didn't save any of my money. I enjoyed my time, but
like most 20 something year olds. Yeah.
Right. You know? And so I was like, man, you know, I didn't save any money, but I didn't spend more than I made. And I was like, I'm getting engaged.
No debt, but not a big savings.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't, you know, go crazy in debt or anything. I just really didn't, I used what I got while I was over there. So the biggest thing was like, how do I support another human being? Like, I don't even know what that costs, what that looks like. Didn't realize how much, you know, toilet paper that females use. So I was like, we need a budget for these things.
I give my wife shit for it all the time. I'm like, more than anybody I've ever met.
So, you know, really, we originally got an apartment for like 6 months because I hadn't been living in the States for a while. I had no idea what the area was like. I heard some parts of Bragg were bad. I was like, I just want to kind of get a lay of the land. So we rented for a little bit and I started going like, let me just see what our burn rate is, like how much are we spending and then like how much income is coming in. We won't change anything. I just want to see what it looks like. And it came very apparent that the highest cost is your housing expense. And, you know, unless you live in a trailer and you know, rent a Lambo or something, like there's very few instances where that, you know, is reversed.
Yep.
So I always kind of was handy and stuff and knew that you could put sweat equity into houses and kind of get a little bit out of that. So we found it for sale by owner. I picked it up for, I think they had it listed at 113. We got it at 103. It's maybe very low. It's probably pretty much at market, you know, with cutting out realtors and other stuff. So we did a few things to it and like fixed it up as we were going along. And then 3 years later, we sold it. And in the process of that, actually, my wife got her license because we realized how like complicated the process was. And we had to actually, because we sold it by owner. So I guess she got her license after the fact, but we went through the whole contract and learned the whole process. And, you know, when the dust settled and I ran the numbers, I essentially like broke even, right? Like the 3 years I would have been spending in rent and the money I put into the house, I pretty much got back. But leading up to us selling that, you know, I learned about house hacking just through like listening to podcasts. And it was like, if I could do it over again, I think, you know, we should just do a house hack instead of just buying a house, you know, and quote unquote flipping it.
Sure. Kind of like a live and flip.
Yeah, you know, but we didn't really buy a deep enough discount to really call it a live and flip. Honestly, if I had to hire people out, like we would have been, you know, negative equity. It was just me doing all the stuff myself.
Yep. Sounds like my house I currently live in. I've been doing that for 4 years now.
Just constantly
upgrading it.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that gave us like a down payment and, you know, luckily we didn't have to use it because we ended up using a VA loan, which is 0% down. Mm-hmm. So I would say the biggest thing was the podcasts, learning about the concepts, and then going to local meetups is probably the most underrated thing in the world. I met a really good group of people that I'm still friends with to this day. They have their meetups called Pints and Properties. They have it across the whole nation now.
Cool.
So I just kept showing up and was like, I want a house hack. Like, I have money to do it and I have a VA loan. Like, I want to use it. And so, you know, one of those agents that knew I kept showing up and asking and what I wanted to accomplish hit me up and was like, hey, there's 11 duplexes on the street. There's two left. We need to put an offer like today if you want to get one. So, and actually my parents were visiting. So I was like, dude, I know we're like grilling right now, but we need to pause and go look at this house. So yeah, went up there and looked at it and we got under contract and that started our house hacking adventure with like an actual, you know, duplex.
Nice.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
I like the Pints and Properties. There's a guy in Kansas City who has crafts and property, like craft beer and properties or something like that. And it's kind of their
Pints thing. And Properties just has a nicer ring to it, though.
Yeah. It does. It might not be like crafts and properties. It's something like craft brew or I don't know, something like that. But it's the logo for it's really cool. And they basically, you know, sit at picnic tables and drink beer and have snacks and talk real estate.
Yeah, very similar concept. And I don't even think it's not even a franchise because I talked to the person that runs it, the one here in Charlotte, they need a host for it. But, you know, it's all over the U.S. I can't remember how many locations they have, but there's quite a few.
That's cool.
That's cool. Kind of reminds me of, if you remember Vinny, Adam McChesney, who was on here like December, his podcast is Entrebrewer. Some similar kind of concept, but his whole studio's set up with it. I think he's rebranding it, but it's all set up with that. So
I love a good craft beer, man, but it makes me feel really bad. So I don't
same, dude. Same. I don't drink much anymore, and when I do, every time I'm like, this is why I don't drink anymore, because I just feel like crap.
I mean, it's just beer that does it to me. Nothing else. Like,
really?
Okay. And I can have a glass of wine and be fine. It's probably just, you know, the carbs in it, or I don't know what it is, but I love a good, like an IPA. It's so good.
Whatever hops are, it's those things.
Yeah. It's those things.
So good.
Yeah. I'm like wine or scotch, no in between. It's very weird dynamic.
You're what now?
I'm either going to have a glass of wine or scotch. Like, there's literally no in between for me. I just don't do beer anymore.
That's fair. That's how I am too. Like, when I do drink, it's either like bourbon or wine. Like, and it's very rare. Like, it's two or three times a year, if that.
Yeah.
Same. That's funny. Yeah, dude. Okay. I couldn't tell you last time I had a beer. It's been a minute. Well, cool. So we talked about this a little bit before we hopped on, but let's talk about the most interesting property I've ever seen somebody put under contract. and talk through that process. So it's a mixture of a church and a laundromat. Is there anything else with it?
A duplex.
And a duplex. Yeah. So a church, laundromat, duplex, all in one.
Dude, I'm telling you, if you want your one-way ticket onto bigger pockets, someone just needs to house hack this thing. It'd be like the ultimate house hack. There you go.
Like, I figured this out.
I live in one side, but also run a laundromat and a church.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, let's talk about that one, because I know you've dealt with that one for, man, over a year? Like, close to it? Seems like it's been a while.
We went under contract mid-September, I think.
Okay.
Somewhere around in the fall of last year, right?
Okay.
And that was a cash purchase, you know. We do mostly direct mail. That came off of a direct mail campaign. It came up because there was a duplex there. And we were looking for a small multi. I didn't even have any clue that the rest of the stuff, you know, was part of it. I just came there thinking I was looking at a duplex. So
a duplex, yeah.
Yeah. It's a half acre parcel that's paved. And it's got those three buildings on it, duplex, laundromat, church. Please keep in mind, this is North Carolina, so you could drop, you know, a Connex building outside, a metal box outside and put a cross on it, and it's considered a church. It's a
church, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
It used to be a grocery store.
Okay, right. We have a lot of, like, in St. Louis, we have a lot of, like, newer, like almost like a startup church, I guess you would say. That'll be in like strip malls or at the YMCA or, you know, a lot of like small locations like that. So it's probably pretty similar to where you're at.
Exactly. So basically, I went to go look at it. The laundromat hasn't been running for a while. He got sick during COVID and kind of closed the doors because he didn't have anyone to come out and run it for him. And then duplex is pretty rough, like very rough. It's probably the worst roof I've ever seen in my life. I mean, you can even see from Google Satellite how bad it is. And the church, same thing. It's just a hodgepodge of buildings put together, and it's just weird. So we came in, and it was something so weird not knowing how to dispo it, like to sell to someone else, because I just really have no business running something like that. We kind of shot him an offer at 135. Wasn't thrilled about it, but you know, he just needs to get rid of it and sell it. So the trouble was, all the people that came to look at it, that were looking to buy it, that were very interested, couldn't get financing on it, which makes sense, because even though it's neighborhood,
because of, like, what the property was.
Yeah, well, no one's going to loan on a business that doesn't have revenue for the last 2 years. Like,
that's fair.
Understandably so. So after that didn't work out, and then also we kind of started doing some more due diligence on the actual laundromat itself, and the owner was talking about how, oh, when I last had it running, there was only two machines, just needed repaired. And they need, I think the guy that's buying it is actually going to replace all the machines. So turned out to be in worse condition than he alluded to, and we kind of went back to do like a retrade. Although, you know, I really was just coming back to tell him, like, I'm not really sure we can even buy this thing. I really wasn't going back to just try and, you know, cut him as low as I can and then push it, because I mean, it didn't really matter. I mean, at some point someone would buy it for cash at low enough price, but people couldn't get financing on it. So we kind of got into a conversation of like, well, you know, what do you need to pay this thing off? And he had like an old statement around, and you know, he owed like 128 or 129 or something like that on it. You know, we were offering 135. So I'm not huge into the whole sub two thing. You know, I just have quality conversations with people and actually like listen to what's going on in their life. And then we just make offers based on what makes sense. Like, I never come into anything with an exit already in mind. But I mean, realistically, to get this thing done, it was the only option. So we had a very honest upfront conversation about it, because in my mind, a sub two deal, if you're not just doing sub two for a quick flip, in my mind, you're in it for the long haul. So I explained to him that basically we will be taking over the mortgage payments, but the mortgage will still be there. Like, it is not going away. It's still technically in his name. It's just going to be in a trust, but we're just responsible for making the payments. You know, he can't pay it off early. Like, all, I just was very clear about what the process is going to be, because I think too many people, you know, don't be extremely transparent, honest. And then if in 2-3 years they call you up, like, what the heck, you know, what's going on? And it's, you'd rather just do it up front and figure it out. So, once we got it under contract for, you know, the sub two kind of thing, taking over the mortgage, I sent it out again, you know, this time owner financing to an end buyer. And I mean, there was just tons of people that wanted to buy it now, because it solved the whole financing issue. And that's actually what I had a call this morning about. We're looking to close this Friday on the trust. And then once the deed is transferred, we're good to go on basically transferring the beneficial interest to the end buyer. That doesn't really require closing. It's just a notary document. And then, yeah, they'll be running to the races. He's already got his roofer on standby, ready to fix that duplex and get the laundromat up and running.
So for people that are listening that are new or just kind of getting started, they're pretty new to this, what's the benefit or the reason of putting in a trust?
So as far as I was briefed from the dude who does this, like, this is all he does for a living. I would make sure you find someone who, this is what they do.
Knows what they're doing. Yeah.
For sure. So the benefit is essentially the seller's putting it into a trust. And when the trust should be named something along the lines of, you know, either the owner's name or the street address, preferably the street address. And basically what that tells the bank is that the the deed has been moved into a trust, and the trust is, you know, like the street address. So there's no like red flags that the deed has been transferred to someone else. Mm-hmm. And legally, mm-hmm. it hasn't. So like at first, we do have to put the property into a trust with him. You know, he is actually going through this company and setting it up just as he would if he wasn't selling the property. And so there is a little bit of trust there. And there's also like the document that he signs saying like, well, once I put it in the trust, I will, you know, give you beneficial interest kind of thing. But basically the reason you're doing it is because technically like nothing happened where you can trigger that due on sale clause. As long as if it moves into a trust and the deed isn't moving into, you know, someone else's LLC or name, the insurance also needs to, you know, be in the trust and not move over to someone's name, and then you make the payments, there really is no reason that it should get called due. But we've also explained to him up front that there is a possibility. Like that is still a chance. It'd be very, very uncommon. And he made it basically seem like they don't even have the legal right to investigate the trust as long as you close it right. So essentially, it's what I was briefed on. If you're trying to do it longevity wise, which I am, because in this case, I'm turning into the bank. Like I've got his loan, and then we're taking this guy and forming a loan, you know, for a greater price. And then when he pays me, I pay off the first position loan, and we're just going to carry on that relationship and collect the money in between. So I want it as airtight as possible from now on to not worry about, hey, dude, by the way, the bank called and saw that you did something incorrectly and that it transferred.
Got it. Okay. I don't think I ever would have figured that out without somebody helping me.
There was, we actually had a CCF call that was perfect timing the other day. I don't remember his name, but
Derek Dombeck.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So he was a guest on here. I don't know. First 10, I think.
Probably November. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was one of the first 10. Yeah.
Okay. Well, just forget what I just said and go listen to that one, because he's way,
he's
way more smart on it and can put it way more clearly.
Yeah.
So these are separate buildings or all one building?
Mm. Yeah, great question. So three separate buildings, one parcel.
Just on the same lot. Okay.
Yeah, and the way it's like laid out, you have to like drive past the duplex, and the church makes like a little, you can fit like two cars through it, and then the laundromat's in the back. Mm-hmm. Because that was a question from the M buyers. He's like, can I subdivide and put these in different, like, because he's got a holding company for the rental, and then he's got a different LLC for like his laundromat. He owns another laundromat. And I was like, dude, it's really not possible because of, like, you need like a weird easement. Like, there's no way you would block off the laundromat if you were to subdivide like access to it.
Do you know, like, so I know this guy got sick like around COVID, but before that happened, do you know what he was doing with all of this? Like, was he running a laundromat, renting out the duplex, and like letting people use the church? Like, how did that kind of work?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his claims are, and he won't give me any documentation to support it, of course, but you're right. Yeah. He says he was making around $80,000 a year on the laundromat, and then the duplex, at its time, I think he had it rented for like 400. Right now there is one person in there at 175 who's not even paying rent, and he one of the end buyers that came to look at it, the tenant came out with a chainsaw. So he's been really fun to deal with.
Oh, wow. Ooh, okay.
And then the church is renting for 425, but they're only using like a third of the building, and the guy that's actually buying it, his contractor is he's a full-time pastor, I guess half part-time contractor, so he's actually reached out to them to see what they can do about like better use of the building space and keeping that running.
How many square foot is the church?
I never actually calculated the square footage of it, just kind of from GIS. I drew like a length by width, and I don't have those numbers in front of me, but if I had to take a guess, probably like 34,000 square feet or something like that. It's like pretty massive.
Oh, okay.
It's a long rectangular. I mean, it used to be a grocery store.
Did you say 34,000?
No, sorry. 3 to 4, so like 4,000. Like, oh, yeah. Not a warehouse. Like, no.
I was going to say 3 to 4, or what is it, 425 a month? I was like, this makes no sense.
Yeah.
3 to 4,000, got it.
Yeah.
Still pretty big.
It's single story, so like it's just a super long rectangular building.
Okay.
So I'm curious about that with, you know, like zoning and taxes and stuff, you know, with churches and congregations, like how is that even being handled?
I think everything else tax deductible on the lot. No,
I'm wondering.
I know. He didn't mention anything about that, and I don't know, because if they're just renting it and like you own the land, you own everything, the whole parcel and the other buildings. Don't know if there's any tax benefits there. I mean, to be honest, the moneymaker is the laundromat, and that's, you know, when I was looking for an end buyer, I was looking for someone who has ran a laundromat before, and you know, knows what they're doing in that aspect. The rest of the stuff is kind of, wouldn't call it like icing on top. I mean, the church really is the wild card. It literally, like, it used to be a grocery store. It could be anything, anything you want it to be. So in his mind, he's going to get the duplex up and running. You know, that thing will probably rent for, I mean, it could be $900 to $1,100 a side, depending on how nice you do it. Okay. He plans on, you know, renovating that first to get it so he can just keep paying us every month and then start working on the laundromat.
What a deal.
It's an interesting one. Like, I don't know if I would recommend it. Like, it's great that it worked out now. And it was very low. Like, the seller was not beating me down about like, hey, when are we going to sell? Like, I'm actually trying to get a hold of him now. I haven't heard back from him in a minute, to see if we can get it signed this week. And then end buyer wise, he's also been very, you know, chill about it. So if this is one of those ones where like it was taking more of my time daily, I don't think it would have been worth it. It's just been drawn out because of how weird it was. But it didn't actually take a ton of bandwidth from me. It's just been drawn out.
It's been drawn out and weird.
Yeah. Like pretty much every, you know, property we seem to see. Like, I went to go look at one the other day that was a warehouse slash, like, they lived in one side of the warehouse. He was like a plumber, but he connected his sewer to his old house, but he sold the house, and so we can't connect to it anymore. It's just this, you find the weirdest stuff, and it's, people think it's worth gold, and you kind of have to like do all this work to figure out how you can even make something of it.
Yeah. So when you got this property we were just talking about, you got it through a direct mail campaign.
Yeah.
Did this seller call in? How many did you have to follow up pretty frequently? Was it on the first drop? Like, what'd that look like?
Yeah. I probably should have had that pulled up. It'll be in RE Simply somewhere, but I know they responded from a mail campaign. It would have been, that's probably one of our best ones, was the apartment postcards, because we were like calling out, you know, what they have is a duplex on there. Yeah. I'm actually surprised though, because he has a laundromat, that he didn't call in and be like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. don't remember timing wise, I didn't have to follow up a ton, honestly. Like, it was a couple of phone calls, and really it was pretty low on my radar, you know, because it was just so weird. And I was struggling over coming up with like a value for it of what I could put under contract for and then reasonably, you know, sell it for. But he was pretty motivated to sell. So I just kind of shot out a number. He wasn't super like thrilled about it. And it just, I don't have a number, but it didn't take a ton of follow up. Yeah. And I also was trying to sort of reverse wholesale it because it was so weird. Talked to a couple of developers, because of the zoning, you know, you can get a bunch of townhomes in there. You can do multifamily up to 4 stories. So I originally was looking for like a developer to kind of reverse wholesale it to, but they had too many, you know, unknowns, unanswered questions for them to really stick a number to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is direct mail your only marketing strategy that you do, or do you have like kind of multiple verticals?
Yeah. So for me, so last year was the first year for my company full time as Sweet Tea Properties. And we decided to just go with direct mail from the get go. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a brand name search, right? So if someone searches Sweet Tea Properties, there's an ad for it, just so it's really just for proof of brand. But we don't really have any other like PPC, or we did set up Facebook retargeting, but we never got a big enough audience for it to actually fire. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to answer your question, that basically we did direct mail for a year straight as our single lead source.
Awesome.
Got it.
For marketing source.
Within that year from starting it and from the beginning, what would you say was like your biggest struggle you had?
Man, I'm trying to think back to what I was actually worried about because all of it was stupid now that I think.
Right. Like, usually ends up not being as big as you thought it was, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess in general, just underwriting deals because, you know, I've been here now for like 3 years in the Charlotte area, but I wasn't like super familiar with everything. And, you know, I wasn't too worried about like money-wise for marketing and stuff. I think that, you know, I don't have a super sexy story about swiping everything on Amex and putting it on, you know, black and going for it.
Yep.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, man. Whatever your risk tolerance can tolerate. So but
you've got that risk tolerance.
Doing the house hacking thing and living like super responsibly. I mean, I essentially lived for free for like almost 5 years between the live and flip and then the house hack. So I had a good enough runway to basically know that I could give this like an actual college try, not just do direct mail for 2-3 months and say this doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then another thing too, doesn't really answer the question, but it was a really great piece of advice I got from Dylan. I was like, hey man, I want to start off like with direct mail. And he's like, well, what's your budget? And I was like, well, I originally want to set aside, I think it was like 15 grand or something like that, for direct mail. And I think the minimum they recommended at the time was it 2 grand a month or something like that at a bare,
like 2,500 pieces.
2,500.
Yeah. So it'd be like $3,300 a month or so.
Yeah. And he's like, dude, let me do you a solid. Like, it was tough for him his first year. It was like basically paycheck to paycheck because of doing low volume mail. And he's like, if you've got 15 grand, he's like, do 5,000 a month for 3 months. And he's like, I know it sounds crazy because you're going to run out in 3 months. But he's like, I promise you, because of just timing, just being out, like having your mail out there and timing, it works out better. And yeah, I took his advice on it and it worked out really well.
At that quantity too. Yeah, it's funny. I had a call with a potential customer yesterday, and that was the exact question he had. And I'm pretty sure he talked to Dylan also, because he's in CCF as well. But he was like, it's like, you know, should I do, you know, 2,000 a month for 10 months or should I do like 5,000 a month for 5 months? And I was like, 5,000 a month for 5 months all day long. Like,
yeah,
you're going to get better results. It's going to be quicker. You're going to build your pipeline and you'll be, especially if you're impatient, like a lot of people are nowadays, like it's going to work a lot better for you to do a little bit of a higher volume. Yeah.
Yeah. I think underwriting probably was the difficult part. And I just kind of followed that whole reverse wholesale model where you literally just go find an end buyer and ask them what they can pay for it. And then, you know, what you have to get under contract for. And that worked out really well just to kind of get a feel for the market. And if you're really that afraid that you're going to put something under contract that's not going to move, because, you know, I also think you shouldn't be putting stuff just under contract and dropping out, you know, as much as you meet these very interesting people, they do have stuff going on in their lives and you don't want to promise them something. They pack up their house, get ready to move. And you're like, ooh, sorry,
yeah,
realized I couldn't pay that type of thing.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Justin, I just locked up a deal. Do you think I should do 5,000 mailers a month for the next 3 or 4 months?
Oh yeah, we need to talk about your deal also.
Not on this one though.
I would, dude. I also got extremely, I say luck, but I don't know what that saying is about, you know, preparation and opportunity or something when they cross paths is I guess what luck is. There's some fancy saying for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like our first wholesale deal was I think 31 or something like that. So okay. I mean, I didn't have to like sit around and have the faith for it, like and sweat it out. I think that was like on our third month, but I mean, that covered the marketing and then some, you know what I mean? Like, also, because I'm financially responsible and stuff and built a nice nest egg to give this thing a good go, I didn't have to take a huge chunk of that out to pay for my living. And it literally all just went back into the business.
Yeah.
And from then I was like, dude, 5,000 a month, like it's, I don't care. Like I'm just mailing consistently as much as I can the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about the deal, Justin, when Matt camps on April 4th.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah,
we'll save it.
That's when we got
to
do it.
So if you're listening, you'll have to wait until Matt Camp is on here from Deal Machine. So Vinny's playing with us.
Yeah. Yep. Matt is awesome, man. He's one of the most genuine, like, kind-hearted, just true dude that you'd ever meet.
He's a good dude. I like him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I had a question related to something, Dom, and then I forgot what it was.
Now it's disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, it had something to do with when you said something about runway, not the Air Force, but
I guess being financially responsible and saving up and until you're ready to go full time.
We all get that. Like, what was that question? I don't know. It'll come.
I will say it wasn't like some 10-year plan that like happened. Like, dude, I got laid off and I was like, at least I had the nest egg now. And then I was like, I'm going to start real estate investing now. Like I had, that was a backup plan. I wasn't even really technically saved up and ready for it. But, I thought I needed more money than I did to get started. So there was some urgency to it. It's not like I just said, oh, life is happening perfectly by my plan of hitting these numbers.
I get that.
Sorry. Do you, and with some of your military buddies, have they been curious about what you've done? Have they asked about it? Have you coached or mentored anybody in the military on this?
Yeah. I mean, I get dudes at drill all the time asking me about, it's so funny because every time I talk to them, they're like, how many houses do you own now? And like, that's for whatever reason, the metric. And we've been flipping and wholesaling just about everything. I've definitely, there's some people that have been interested and I try and give them as much guidance as I can. And trying to think back to when, I started and knowing a lot of these dudes have other jobs, and they're just trying to do it part-time, has been great. This year I've talked to a lot of people about it and they're just like, dude, I'm just too busy. If there's a way I can be involved and not like have to actually do anything day to day. And that's, we kind of got into the conversations about private lending. So
lending. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been really helpful. And that's kind of the part I'm excited about moving forward is like getting other people involved and having them make money. Like, don't get me wrong. I like money. It's fine. But like after wholesaling, you get a check and then it's just like, cool. And then it's just back to work, back to the grind doing it again. So I think that's the part that I'm more excited about is getting some of my buddies involved, getting them money on the private lending side. And then, starting to build a team now and them earning like commissions and stuff based on it. It's kind of more what I'm looking forward to than just doing more deals for the sake of doing more deals.
Yeah. Have you done a deal with a VA loan?
So my house hack was a VA loan, in a VA loan. The house I'm sitting in right now was off market. And it's in a VA loan as well.
Yeah.
So you can't have more than one. Loan,
man. You can. Yeah. Yeah. I've had three under a VA at one time.
Yeah. A lot of misnomers about it. Dude, there's tons of content out there about it. Just research it. I promise you there's just don't do the weird sketchy ways. If you do hear about people talking in gray or technicalities about how long you have to live in the property or if you have to move into it at all. Like, I mean, if weigh your pros and cons and your risks here, but for me, if I'm using a VA loan, I'm going to move into it. I'm going to live in it.
It's going to be your primary. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you can just refinance the one you're not living in, put it under a conventional or something or, whatever you need to do.
Yeah. But, if you run out of an entitlement. Yeah. So like we came to buy this house, we had plenty of entitlement left to buy this and keep the duplex. Another cool thing I learned too, and I know this is uber specific to VA loans, but so when housing, the interest rates drop, they kept hitting me up. They're like, dude, you should do a VA IRL, which is just an interest rate reduction loan. And I was like, dude, I don't live in the property anymore, man. Like, it's not even my primary. And they're like, I don't care. It's a VA loan, dog. And I was like, wait, so I can drop the interest rate and keep in a VA loan and not be living in it? And they're like, absolutely. It's like $1,000 to do it. And I think it dropped from a 3.37 down to like a 2.5.
Nice.
I think it took like
sold.
Yeah, like $150 bucks off of the rent, mortgage. So
Yeah, I love the VA loans, man. They're They're fantastic. I take advantage of every single veteran's benefit that I possibly can ever.
Yeah.
Like,
might as well. It's there.
Yeah. We're taking the kids. We're leaving on Friday. We're going on vacation. And I just do research beforehand on like what places have veteran discounts and, you know, things like that. And, you know, I can, when you're said and done on a vacation, you can save thousands just yeah. by using your, yeah. you know, your veteran discount. So, but yeah, the VA is great. It is I like it too, that once you're approved, you're approved.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't have to go back, you know, and get reapproved if you want to go, and they just have everything there.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Also, we used the ours for this during COVID, and it was, I mean, very weird times, but they were checking like weekly. They're like, we're going to call your supervisor the week before closing and make sure you still have a job. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
When you're everyone at that time was like, we're going to quadruple check everything.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You're not laid off. You laid off yet?
Yeah. You still have a job. Surprising. Okay. We're going to keep going.
I don't think they ever called
it. It is unfortunate though, on the retail side, when you're a buyer and you want to use a VA loan, you know, sellers and realtors are like, yeah, it's a VA loan, you know,
yeah,
get all, you know, bent about it and stuff. But if you're in the military, use it.
I'll say, why do they get all annoyed with it?
Closing, inspections, appraisals only can be done through, you know, a VA.
Got it. Just like some of the processes behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of similar, I think, to like FHA when someone sees it. There's like just some extra, I wouldn't say rules. And like, honestly, I think they've gotten a lot better, and it depends on who uses a lender as far as like how long the closing will take. Like our first one we used, Navy Federal, great for rates, but holy crap, are they slow. And you as a homeowner buyer, like I want the lowest rate, but you don't realize you might blow up the deal by, you know, getting an extra 0.25% off, with it taking 60 plus days to close because they just drag their feet and have their own processes.
Yeah,
that's true. Interesting. Yeah, I've never used one, so I don't know, cause I can't use them. So, well, cool. What's to kind of wrap it up. Like if you're giving up advice to somebody who's new, cause the whole point of this is like helping people get their next deal, right?
Yeah.
What's the one thing you would give out as a piece of advice to somebody who's new trying to get their next deal?
I would just have as many actual quality conversations with people as you can, and then just follow up. Like, and when you say follow up, I would define it. We talked with another dude on a CCF call or Monday night call about that with his follow up, and you know, leading into it, I kind of just said, "Oh, I'll follow up." What does that look like? Like when they call in. Do you call them back like same day? Are you going to call them back every day until they answer? And then after that week, every other day, like just define what it looks like and stick to it. Because if you don't, you'll go off a feel and you're never going to get it right.
Yep.
the fortune is definitely in the follow-up, but I will say if you're not having quality conversations with people up front, you're probably not going to get to the follow-up. So I would focus, if you can get them on the phone, you shouldn't be talking more than they are. Like, let them talk and like embrace the awkward silence for a little bit and just let them talk about what's going on. Now, I mean, you will get the occasional older person who will want to tell you their entire life story, and you do sometimes need to steer it back to the right direction.
Yep.
But man, if you're starting out, it doesn't matter. There's all kinds of lead sources, but you got to know what to do when the leads come in. And my thought process is just have as many quality conversations as you can. Set what follow-up means in your book, and then stick to it, and deals will come.
Yep. Agreed. That's I always tell people there's two reasons people fail in this business, and it's lack of marketing or lack of follow-up.
Yeah.
It's usually like the two main things. And there's to run on a brief tangent real quick to kind of wrap that up. But like, I see it with people in CCF or other business owners I know through some of the other coaching groups I'm in. And it's like a lot of people don't realize, or they don't focus on the leads and the deals first, right? They're worried about the system and the process and the delivery and all that kind of stuff, right? Which is great, but there's no point in doing that until you have enough leads and deals, right? Yeah. Like I was talking to somebody a week ago, who's been a mentor of mine over the years. And he was like, if you're under $1 million a year, systems are not your problem.
Yeah.
Delivery is not your problem. Market or, you know, financing and all that kind of stuff. That's not your problem. Your problem is leads and deals and getting cash flow into the business. He's like, let the stuff break and fix it when it breaks. He's like, that's when you know that you're getting to that point. But focusing on those leads and deals and follow-ups, good conversations, is such an important thing for people to focus on, especially if you're under $1 million a year in revenue.
Yeah.
So yeah, 100% agree.
And it might sound a little woo-woo, but I really think the reason people aren't having quality conversations is you're going into it with like an exit or goal in mind, and you're not listening to what they're saying. Like, you really truly can't. And it's funny because people ask, well, what do you do? Are you a flipper, wholesaler? And I'm like, dude, I just find good deals. Like, sometimes, most of the time they're off market, very seldom they're on market, but I legitimately just have a conversation with people and figure out what's going on and see what makes the most sense where it serves them, but we also obviously are a for-profit company. We have to make something out of it as well. So
yeah,
if you just go around with your square peg trying to find where it fits, like you're going to get so much resistance and you're not listening. Especially, again, I'm not trying to just throw a ton of shade on the sub-2 crowd, but I've so many times they just come in and if you're starting with the exit in mind and you're going like, oh, well, you could take payments. If they didn't mention it, dude, just don't bring it up. Like, if it's an option that makes sense, then bring it up.
It's a tool, not everything that you should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I kind of learned that the hard way, not too recently, maybe in the last couple of weeks on a mobile home where I was, you know, offering that and it just shut them down immediately.
Yeah. Oh, really?
And I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah. So
I love what you just said there, Dom.
Yeah, our first flip was owner financing, and they did not want to do owner financing from the get-go. And I did a terrible job of explaining it because I got too technical. But when I finally just broke it down like I would if I was explaining it to like my little sister or something, like they understood it, and they had the two options. I was like, look, we can pay you this in cash if you want to go. I know you need, you know, $150, and we could make that happen. It would just look like this. And then they understood it and they went for it. But it really wasn't, you know, when they pulled back, I did, you know, I didn't force it, but I realized, you know, sometimes it is, you're not explaining it correctly. And you just need to be more simple with your explanation, you know, her. Yep. And it was with her goal was in mind, right? Like, she had a house in South Carolina, they owed $150 on it. So that's why that's the least they could take. And I just said, we simply couldn't pay, you know, $150 for it. But I finally got to meet them here face to face at the house, and I was like, well, what is your mortgage payment? And I think they said it was like eight something. And I was like, so if I paid you $850 a month until we're finished like renovating that house, would that, you know, serve the same purpose? And they're like, oh, never thought about it that way. So they thought about it on their drive back, and they're like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, I'll cover your mortgage until we renovate the house, and when we sell it, you'll get the $150, and you can pay off your house.
That's cool. I like it. Well, awesome. Vinny, did you have anything else to wrap up with?
No, that was it. I just had my mic on mute there for a second. Sorry, the kids were...
Kids are all home. Yep.
And I didn't want to intervene there. No, man, it was really cool actually meeting you, you know, I guess we can say in person. I know you and I have had phone calls and stuff before.
Yeah.
Really love that... you know, you're a veteran, you know, just seeing you in CCF. I love how you do, you know, business, very ethical. You seem like a pretty awesome dude, kind. You really are, you know, listening to people. And I truly do see that in you, based upon this podcast and what I see in CCF. So
thanks, dude. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, man. This was a lot of fun. Appreciate you hanging out with us and sharing your story.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.